can't think of a cliche to start with.
I'm waiting for you to say this week.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Spotify, US Radio and Google. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. I have with me Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
You read that word for word. I know we always have notes. I'm sure people know we have notes because the podcast is so fluent and without error. But I didn't realise you read that bit word for word.
I don't normally.
Like a script.
But I did then.
You did.
Because I got it right this week.
I have with me Chris Cook. It says it here.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Stop lifting the curtain and just respond. I just said hello. Just say that.
I was looking for stop lifting the curtain on the notes then. I wondered what you were talking about. But now I understand. It's a Wizard of Oz reference, isn't it? Is that a Wizard of Oz reference? Lifting the curtain?
I'm not sure.
Don't know. Hey, we're back.
Yeah.
I went to Tallinn Music Week last week.
And that's why we weren't here.
That's why we weren't here.
We also forgot to warn people we wouldn't be here.
But
we're back now.
We're back. Everyone who was at Tallinn Music Week would have realised that.
I can do a quick... if I record a bit now, people can like chop it out and put it into last week's podcast.
A sort of DIY. Yeah.
So just this next bit, just put in the end of... You just chop it out and put it in the end of last week's podcast.
Like when you print something and then there's an error on it and then you have to print a load of stickers and stick them on. I'm sure any sort of gig promoters listening to this podcast can empathise with that sort of rubbish fix to a problem.
Anyway, I'll just do that and then
okay.
We can move on.
Okay.
We're not going to be here next week, so listen to something else or listen to this podcast again and you'll hear me. But then you'll hear me saying, we're not going to be here next week, but if you listen to this bit last week...
This is way longer than was necessary.
Hang on. You might end up accidentally... Listen to the bit that you haven't... Listen to the file that you haven't edited this into if you listen to it again next week, which is now last week, because you don't want me to say that we're not going to be here next week when next week is now, which is the week we're back. So have two versions...
That ended up being quite long, that, didn't it?
Yeah. I've confused.
I'm not sure.
I think that worked. It worked.
I went to Tallinn Music Week.
Did you?
And that's why we weren't here last week. And yeah. You know what? Lots of interesting things came out of the Tallinn Music
Tell
Week conference.
Tell me a thing you learned.
But one thing I thought was interesting is they are launching music charts in the Baltic region. So that's Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania for the first time.
Well, they've not had music charts before. How did they know what was popular?
Because you sort of assume that every country in the world has everything we have, because we're arrogant Brits.
Yeah.
Like that, and we have a chart, so presumably everybody else has a chart. But
I mean, I think most other places do have a chart.
I think you're being an arrogant Brit.
I think even North Korea has charts.
I think...
They have their own version of Top of the Pops.
I think you're...
Kim Jong-un... comes in number one every week.
Mistakenly assuming that all the people of the world care what the most played / bought / streamed music of the previous week was.
Who would not care? Oh, hang on. No one cares about their hair, do they? So, fair point, yeah.
So yes, they're launching music charts. The Finnish record industry are leading on it, apparently. And then they're hoping it will be embraced by the local music industries and music communities in each of those countries. And they're going to be putting together Spotify and Apple and all of the various streaming data. Certainly in Estonia, Spotify, I think, is now the dominant service for streaming. There aren't any official figures, although someone reckoned that they had about 100,000 subscribers. This is unverified. It was rumour, but it was rumour from a reliable source.
Okay.
1.3 million people live in Estonia, so 100,000 sign up Spotify. That's pretty good, isn't it?
That is a sizable portion of the population.
And they reckon probably about 40,000 of them are paying. Again, unverified. But if that's true, bearing in mind that these have always been quite small markets, actually, for emerging territories like that, that could be that the local record industry there, whereas here in the UK, even though people are optimistic because the record industry is back in growth, we might mention later that the US figures for 2016 were revealed while we were away and confirmed quite significant growth in the American market. But it seems unlikely that the US and the UK, etc., are ever going to return to their 1990s peak of the CD days when they were bringing in sort of double the money that they're bringing in now. However, markets like the Baltic region, they could become more successful in terms of revenue and profit than they ever were in history.
Especially with those charts.
especially now they've got their charts. So, yeah, it's interesting. As I've been to a few conferences, I'm thinking of doing some CMU Trends reports on some of these emerging markets. Remember a couple of years ago you did one on digital music in Japan?
Yeah, not so much an emerging market, but I did do that, yeah.
Second biggest recorded music market in the world. Yeah, in fact, the opposite of an emerging market.
For the last very much emerged market.
Yeah, well, for the last few years, it's been a... What's the opposite of emerging? Going away market.
Demerge?
Still the second biggest in the world, though.
Disappearing?
But it's always...
Hearing, that's the daft.
It's always...
You're putting words in my mouth now.
Interesting to work out sort of the peculiarities and the differences of both the recorded music market in general, but specifically the way streaming is going in different countries. So you never know. I write these things down when I go to these conferences. One day I might write them up. Who knows? But anyway, thank you to Tallinn Music Week for having both me and CMU Insights at their event this year.
Yeah, now let's get on with the podcast. Coming up this week, we're going to talk about efforts to get US radio to pay some of the royalties it doesn't pay to record labels currently. We'll be talking about Google's cool funding of extremism. But first, let's talk about Spotify.
Spotify have been back in the news this week because...
Because Spotify never leaves the news.
Well, not our news. I mean, I don't think they were...
It's been in the actual news.
It has. Yes. See, that's the point, isn't it?
I might... mention some more on that in a minute.
They actually made it into non-music business news and even non-music news. It made it into the news this week because Spotify has, after quite some time, agreed a new multi-year deal with Universal Music.
Which has been some time coming.
It has. Now, obviously, they had a deal with Universal Music back in the day. It's not that Spotify has been going all these years without a deal with the biggest record company in the world. There have been streaming services that have been going. I mean, Grooveshark was a case in point that had been going for years without any proper deals in place or just a handful of deals with smaller rights owners. But obviously, back in the day, Spotify did deals with Universal Music. However, like most of the deals with the majors and with Merlin, who represent a big chunk of the indie label sector, those deals usually last for 2 to 3 years. And the last time that Universal's deal came up for renewal, they didn't renew. And so what happens then is basically the old deal just rolls on a month-by-month basis. But at any time, Universal could say, right, that's it, no more music for Spotify. So you don't want to be rolling on a month-by-month basis. That doesn't really give you much security. But they have finally reached a new multi-year deal. And this is important for Spotify at the moment. Why is it important for Spotify at the moment?
Because Spotify wants to float on the stock market, do one of those IPO things.
Initial public offering.
Yes.
Whenever we write IPO in a story in the CMU Daily, and at the moment, normally, it's in relation to Spotify, but other music startups IPO occasionally, I always wonder whether we ought to say initial public offering. Do people know what an IPO is? But then I think...
I think people have an idea that an IPO is something to do with the stock market and they don't really care what it stands for.
Well, and then I think, well, actually, if you write initial public offering, people will be none the wiser.
Yeah.
If they didn't know what an IPO was, they would be none the wiser. I don't know why we don't say flotation anymore. Not that that ever really made any sense. Floating on a stock market. I mean, if you don't know what that means...
I just said it just then.
You did, old-timer you, with your backwards, old-fashioned... investment terminology. But anyway...
I was worried people wouldn't understand what IPO was.
Well, hopefully now they'll have a vague idea. So yes...
Probably, yeah.
Spotify, at some point in the next year, is almost certainly going to IPO. They're going to go probably to the New York Stock Exchange and they are going to make shares available in the company to anybody who wants them.
Yes, anybody at all. They can't stop you from buying shares.
Hence public offering.
That's the public thing.
That's where the P comes from.
We're still explaining this. I don't think we need to.
So anybody will be able to buy shares in Spotify. And what happens at IPO is it's the big payday for the founders and the early investors who can now turn their investment from a few years back into good old cash money.
So that's Daniel Ek and the major record labels.
And the other early investors.
And the other early investors.
Who've wasted several billion getting to this point. Mm. So Spotify need to IPO at some point in the next year. And as I think we've discussed on the podcast before, I think you went into this in quite a lot of detail.
I'm sure I did.
It's now getting expensive for Spotify not to IPO.
Yes, because they got some debt financing. So they got some new investment through a loan rather than straight venture capital. And under the terms of that, past a certain point, every month they don't IPO, the cost of that goes up.
Yeah, so it's in Spotify's interest to IPO sooner rather than later. However, they can't go to Wall Street with their big IPO and the big pack that they'll have to write as part of that. They can't go to Wall Street without deals in place with the big rights owners.
Because you can't say, we've got this great business that's definitely going to be profitable. By the way, we have no deals in place with any of the major rights
owners. And they could all turn us off next month. So they need to go there saying, look, the next 2 to 3 years are all sorted with Universal and with Sony and with Warner and with Merlin and with the big distributors around the world, let alone the publishers and the collecting societies. And we know that the deals with the major labels have been a long time coming. There are various reasons for that. For starters, as far as the record companies are concerned, it's not in Universal Music's interest, or Sony, or Warner, or any of the labels' interest to screw up the Spotify IPO.
No, they want Spotify to be a success because Spotify is obviously a major revenue source for everyone now. However, they also realise that with the IPO looming, their negotiating power is never going to be higher than it is now. So that's why they have spent 2 years negotiating very hard.
Yeah, because it seems almost certain that once the IPO has happened, the next time these deals come up for renegotiation in 2 to 3 years' time, bearing in mind that by that point, Spotify, which is already for the majors a significant single revenue generator, but in 2 to 3 years' time, it could be a majority of their revenue. And so it seems likely that next time round, Spotify will have a very strong negotiating hand at the table. So this was a last opportunity for the majors to really play hardball because they know that A, Spotify needs these deals to float, and B, it's expensive for Spotify to wait too much longer to float, so they could exploit that. There was also the issue that we know that Spotify was trying to get its revenue share arrangement with the majors down slightly.
Yes.
So as we've discussed at great length on the podcast in the past, the streaming services deals with the record companies and the music publishers and collecting artists, they are at heart revenue share arrangements, and Spotify commits to share 70% of its income every month with the music industry. There are then a load of minimum guarantees laid on top of that, which complicate things further. But if we just stick with the revenue share, then in theory, the music industry should see about 70%, which means that Spotify sees about 30% of that money. However, what has happened in recent years is the music publishers, who originally were licensing streaming services through the collective licensing system, but then the big five have started doing direct deals. And what the big five publishers have been slowly doing as the years go by is pushing their revenue share arrangements up. So the publishers were originally on about 10%, then it went up to about 12%. We suspect that Sony ATV, the biggest of all the music publishers, may have got their cut up to about 15%. But for Spotify, that's an issue because they've very much built their business on they have to keep, ultimately, at the moment, they're loss leading, but eventually they have to have a business where every month they get to keep at least 30% of their income in order to be a viable business.
Yeah.
And therefore, they needed the major record companies to agree to put their revenue share down ever so slightly in order for that to work, so that when they go to Wall Street, not only can they say, we've got all our deals in place, they can also say, the business model we have where we get to keep 30% of our revenue is still intact, and that is how ultimately we are going to become a commercially viable, profitable business.
Yes. So we think this is part of what hasn't been made publicly available. We think that part of the deal is that, you know, Universal has agreed preferential rates for Spotify. However, only on the basis of certain growth targets over the next few years. So Spotify will have to perform to a certain level in order to get the lower rate.
Yes, so that's not been made public. So the statements made by Spotify and Universal this week didn't mention any of that. However, a number of sources from various different places have said that that is, yes, Universal have agreed to come down ever so slightly, but it is conditional on growth targets. And Universal have also scored a few kickbacks in return for doing that.
Yeah, windowing.
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 That's
been the big thing in the news.
And with immediate effect.
Yeah.
So I think we spoke about this a few weeks ago because there was a rumour doing the rounds that this was going to be one of the key elements of the new Universal deal. And when the statement came out on Tuesday, it was actually Daniel Ek at Spotify who confirmed that this was now part of Spotify's arrangement with Universal.
So it's really, really good for everyone.
Really good for everybody.
Really good.
So he said that we understand at Spotify that every release is different, and we need to have a bit of flexibility in the way we release records. And that was his way of building up to saying, we've resisted for years now, because there's been a big push for this for some time within certainly the majors. We have resisted for a while the idea that our free users and our paid-for users should have access to different content. So obviously, Spotify distinguishes free from paid-for on functionality. So So obviously the big difference is there's ads on free and there's not on paid for, but there's also functional differences. So you don't get all the mobile functionality if you're on the free version. But they've always resisted the idea that the premium people should get more content than the free users, but they are now allowing that to happen to a point.
Yes. So certain Universal releases will be, they'll be allowed to keep them off the free service for 2 weeks or up to 2 weeks. I guess they can put them in. Maybe it could be a day. It could be 3 days. It could be a week. But up to 2 weeks. And they'll only be available to premium subscribers. And so I guess the hope on Universal's part and Spotify's part is that that will drive free users to sign up to premium service, because it's obviously the premium subscribers who are bringing in the money. And so you want more of them. And so it's hoped that that will be the positive effect of windowing. Although the other fear is that those people will go to YouTube and piracy services and you'll see no money at all.
Yeah, opinion is divided on whether windowing will work. And I suppose, you know, if it does work, then actually Spotify wins as much, if not more, than Universal.
So if it doesn't work, presumably Universal will stop doing it fairly quickly.
So you could say that actually Spotify's big concession, if it works, is actually not a concession at all. Spotify is a winner from that as well. However, yes, you're right, there is that fear that in those 2 weeks, rather than people saying, oh, I'm going to sign up, I'm going to start paying my £10 a month in order to get access to the new, what could it be? Who's on Universal? The new Bieber album. Or they have other artists.
Do they?
They don't just have Justin Bieber. Well, interestingly, they distribute Taylor Swift outside of the US, don't they? And Taylor Swift's bugbear with Spotify has always been that they don't offer the flexibility of only being on premium. Although I suspect, given what she said in the past,
she wanted to be permanently only premium.
Yeah, I don't think a 2 week window will particularly appeal to her. But yeah, so we'll see. I mean, Spotify have generally been resistant of offering this to Premier League artists, let alone to all artists, because they fear it makes their free offer less attractive. So people are more likely to use YouTube for free streaming, and Spotify need people to sign up to the free version, because in doing so, they hope they can then upsell to premium in one way or another.
Yes. Now, I'd mentioned that this news making it out of our bubble into mainstream news.
Or BBC Radio 1 Newsbeat.
Yeah.
It's almost mainstream news.
And see, I don't know if the person I spoke to yesterday had misunderstood the BBC Newsbeat report, or BBC Newsbeat had misunderstood what Spotify are doing. But I was asked yesterday if I was going to sign up to Spotify first.
Spotify first.
And I said, I don't know what that is. What is Spotify first? And they said, oh, well, Spotify's going to offer albums to people who pay 2 weeks ahead of the release date. That is not what Spotify are doing. But if people think that's what Spotify are doing, that might sell some premium subscriptions.
It's true.
You get early access to new releases.
Yes, because Spotify are still putting the tracks live to premium at the same time as Apple and Tidal and everybody else. It's just they're not giving it to the freebie users for those 2 weeks. And this seems to be available to anybody on the Universal roster. So whether that will be a decision driven by label or by management remains to be seen. As you say, if it does turn out that actually we see no spike in premium, even when a big album is put on a 2 week window, we see no spike in premium. And what we see a spike in is YouTube and piracy stats. Then it may be that the labels lose interest in this idea as well.
But currently everyone's happy. Daniel Ek's happy. Uncle Lucy from Universal's happy. Manager's semi-happy.
Yes, the management community put out a statement here in the UK saying, of course we welcome the fact that Spotify has done a new deal with Universal. The vast majority of managers are generally pro-Spotify, so therefore they want Spotify to be successful. They want Spotify to become a commercially viable business. Although what the Music Managers Forum did point out is, well, the fact that we were having the, ooh, what are the financial terms? We hear this. We think this, and this is what sources are saying, and they're saying, yeah, yet another streaming deal with no transparency. And okay, you could say, why should Chris and Andy know the specifics of this deal? There's no reason why we should, really. Although, weirdly, we're more likely to know because people tell us this stuff than artists who are signed to Universal Music or distributed through one of Universal's businesses, like Caroline, who will almost certainly be kept in the dark about the specifics of this deal. And obviously, that's a big issue that the Music Managers Forum is campaigning on, arguing that if artists and managers aren't allowed to know the mechanics of the streaming deals, then they can't make informed decisions about which services they should be championing or indeed audit their income. So yes, the MMF said, we're glad there's a deal. We're not glad that the managers of Universal signed artists will once again be kept in the dark on the specifics. Perhaps Universal will surprise us. I doubt it.
Really, really doubt it.
But you never know. It may be that next week's announcement will be, we've just sent an email out to all of our managers and they're all now fully up to speed on our deal.
No. That won't happen.
Well, in which case, the managers will need to continue lobbying and shouting for that, and hopefully, eventually, they'll get the clarity.
Yes, but as we say, now Universal have signed their deal, it's likely that other major rights holders will slowly fall in line in the next few weeks and months. So we'll probably be back talking about this again soon.
Yes.
So tune in for that.
Yeah, where we'll be saying, Warner have done a deal that we don't really know what it is. Sony have done a deal and we don't really know what it is. Oh, Merlin have done a deal and we don't really know what it is. But hey, lots of windowing. So good news for fans of Windows.
Still to come, some of this week's other news in brief, plus why advertisers are leaving YouTube in droves. But now, American politicians are currently going all out to get some flipping royalties for artists and labels when they get radio play in the US.
So we've almost certainly talked about this on the podcast.
Seems like a thing we would have talked about
before. So American copyright law is unusual
in almost all ways.
Almost all ways.
But in this specific way.
Okay, the specific way in which American copyright law is unusual is that it does not provide a general performing right or performance control for the sound recording copyright at a US-wide federal level. At a state level, go and read this week's CMU Trends article and we can discuss that there. There ain't time to talk about that here. However, US-wide level, there is no general performing right for sound recordings. And what that means in real practical terms is that whereas here in the UK and most other countries in the world, when a radio station plays a track, it has to pay some royalties to the songwriter and publisher of the song and some royalties to the artist and the label of the recording. So everybody gets some income. In the US, the radio stations, these AM and FM radio stations, only have to pay the publishers and the songwriters. They pay zero to the labels and the recording artists. Online and satellite radio does have to pay royalties because in the 1990s, they added a digital performing right into federal copyright law in the US. So the sound recordings do earn royalties from online radio, from Sirius, which is obviously the big satellite broadcaster over there, and of course, personalized radio services like Pandora and iHeartRadio. But classic AM FM stations continue to pay nothing. This sort of came about in the 1970s and pretty much ever since. The US record industry has been lobbying hard to try and get a general performing right into copyright law, or if not, a specific line that says AM FM radio stations have to pay royalties to labels and artists in the same way they do to publishers and songwriters. But the radio lobby is very powerful in Washington, and here we are, 2017, and there is still no general performing right for American sound recordings.
No, but there are two bits of proposed legislation that would get that into US law.
Yes, so there is some support. There is some support in Congress for this, and it's bipartisan. Who knew? An issue on which Republicans and the Democrats could actually collaborate in Congress. And yes, so there are two bits that have basically been announced in Congress in the last couple of weeks, although one of them actually is a re-announcement of a piece of legislation that was originally proposed, I think, 2 years ago. Yeah. Never got through, now back on the agenda with sort of the new Congress that came in late last year. And that's the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act.
Yes.
Because in America, any bit of proposed legislation has to have a sort of cheesy brand name.
Yes, and we'll get on to more of that shortly. But yeah, the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act, which, as you say, is not a new bit of proposed legislation, but it's been knocked back before. And now it's back with a vengeance. Six members of Congress have put it back on the agenda last week, end of last month. And basically what that bit of legislation would do would be to put that performance right into federal law with certain stipulations of how that would be controlled. So there'd be a cap on royalty payments for smaller and non-commercial stations, because that's obviously always a concern, is that if these stations suddenly have to start paying out a percentage of their income to record labels, they won't be able to afford to stay in business.
So, and especially the sort of smaller NPR stations that the music industry supposedly loves, because they tend to champion newer music. And then, yeah, you don't want to put them out of business by suddenly facing them with thousands and thousands of dollars of royalties to pay.
There'd also be measures to ensure artists as well as labels benefit from this. So it's not just the labels hoovering up a load of royalties and keeping it in a mattress.
And that is the norm. And in most other countries where broadcasters do pay royalties on the sound recording, you have the so-called performer extra remuneration. So it means that the performers get paid as well as the labels, and the performers usually get paid directly through the collective licensing system, as happens in the US on the digital side. Anybody licensed through the Sound Exchange Collecting Society, the artists see half of that money directly. And so this legislation specifically says that the same system should be applied to these new royalties.
Yes, and there would also be a rule that the introduction of royalties for artists and labels couldn't be used to reduce the royalties already paid to songwriters and publishers. So the radio stations couldn't say, we already pay, you know, this much money out to music companies. We'll just split that in half and split it between you.
And that's really important to get the songwriting community behind a proposal like this. And obviously, these days, a lot of artists are both recording artists and songwriters. But if there was a risk that that is what would happen, so you add a royalty for recordings, but then immediately the stations just go to BMI and ASCAP, who they currently pay the royalties for the songwriters and publishers to, and said, right, well, we're cutting your royalties in half now. Well, obviously, the songwriters desperately don't want that to happen. So in order to get the songwriters behind this, you need to provide some safeguards. I mean, almost certainly, if this legislation was to go through, they would basically be a compulsory license in the US for radio, which is actually quite common. A lot of countries have a compulsory license. We don't here, actually, in the UK. But most countries do. And so that means that the music industry is obliged to license radio, so the radio stations can't be held to ransom. And usually there are statutory rates, so the law sets the rate. Hence how they could, A, put these caps in place to make sure that smaller radio stations aren't forced out of business, and B, that the recording royalty, if it was introduced, doesn't interfere with the existing song royalty.
But that's all old news, really, because that bit of legislation has been around for ages, and I'm sure everyone listening already knew all of those things. What's new is the Promote Act, which
yes,
has been put forward this week by a couple of people who were actually behind the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act. But they've broken off and they've together created an extra bit of proposed legislation just because, you know, sometimes you need more than one.
This could be called the Calling the Radio Stations Bluff Act.
Yes.
Because the radio industry, unsurprisingly, doesn't want to pay royalties to the record industry, has always lobbied hard on this. And the argument they've used ever since the federal sound recording copyright came into existence in the 1970s, they've always used the same argument, which is, whenever we play your records on our radio station, we're promoting your record. So you should be paying us, if anything. It's free promo, so you should be happy with the marketing. Shut up.
Basically, we offset each other. That's why no money changes hands.
And that's what the radio industry has always said. And then that's why the radio industry is always putting out sort of research that says, oh, radio is still the number one discovery channel for discovering new music amongst the population, which might be true for sort of 25 plus. Or maybe these days it's getting to 30 plus. But I don't think for teenagers you can say that they're discovering all of their new music through radio. And even if it is still a great discovery platform, which I think, you know, it is, whether it is the best, I don't know, but it is still an important discovery platform. But what about all those radio stations who are just playing golden oldies or just playing music from the 1980s? They can't possibly be arguing that they're promoting really old tracks and there are any more record sales coming off the back of that.
But to offset that argument completely, the Promote Act, which stands for the Performance Royalty Owners of Music Opportunity to Earn Act, which is not clunky in the slightest.
You dread to think how long they sat around a table having come up with Promote Act, desperately trying to work out what promote could stand
for. I'm going to read it. Performance Royalty Owners of Music Opportunity to Earn. That is not a collection of words anyone would ever use unless they were trying to create a really try-hard backronym. But basically what this says is that if that's the case, if radio's playing music
for free,
for free is promotion, then artists should have the right to withdraw their music from radio.
And basically say, well, that's lovely, but you know what? I've decided I don't need any promotion, so stop promoting my music. But if you want to pay me to play my music, then that's fine. So that's sort of basically what this new proposal is. I think there's a lot of crossover between the two bits of legislation. I think if Fair Play, Fair Pay was to get through, it would sort of render the Promote Act redundant. Also, if Fair Play, Fair Pay does result in a compulsory license, then the right to veto is taken away. Having said that, it may well be that these two Congress people feel that getting the Fair Play, Fair Pay legislation through is still a tall order, and maybe this sort of smaller, tighter piece of legislation they can get through, although I suspect the big broadcasters are still going to lobby hard against that.
I'm sure someone like Irving Azoff would be very quick to say, right, I'm withdrawing all of my artists from radio entirely. And if you want their music, you can pay for it. Obviously, Irving Azoff represents some big artists.
Oh, it does, although they're also songwriters, aren't they? So then they would lose their songwriting income. So that would then be the playoff. Is the songwriting income worth having? Are we willing to lose that order to play hardball?
This act is calling a bluff. That would be calling another bluff. There'd be bluffs all over the place.
Bluff after bluff after
someone
bluff.
Someone would have to clear up all the bluffs.
Of course, there is already a digital performing right. Slowly but surely, I think more and more people are going to gravitate off the AM/FM network and start listening to music through online channels. I think that's already starting to happen. So it could well be, let's assume it takes a few more years to get all of this through Congress, because nothing happens quickly in Washington. It may well be that the general performing right for the sound recordings in the US becomes law, just as AM/FM radio becomes defunct and redundant, and there are no radio stations left to pay those royalties. But hey, keep fighting, I say.
Something to look forward to.
It is.
Just quickly, time now to look through some of this week's other stories in brief. As you mentioned earlier, double-digit growth in the US recorded music market thanks to all those flipping streams.
Yes, the Recording Industry Association of America put out its stats pack last week, just a few weeks ahead of the International Federation of the Phonographic. All these bloody long... No wonder our podcasts are so long. All the trade bodies have stupidly long names. So the IFPI are putting out the global figures in a couple of weeks, but the American record industry confirmed that they were now into double-digit, just double-digit.
Still.
But nevertheless, bearing in mind that from 2000 to 2010, the record industry's revenues went down, down, down. 2010, 2015, basically flat.
Back into those few years, everyone getting excited about
a 0.01
growth. Yeah.
2015 up, but 2016 some real decent growth in the biggest recorded music market, the US. So that's quite exciting. Although the RIAA, they put a post up on Medium about these stats. And true to form with the modern way in which the record industry's trade bodies comment on anything these days, it was a paragraph of, this is all great, well done record companies for finding a way to reinvigorate and innovate and all of that nonsense.
Shut down YouTube!
Yeah, safe harbours. You know, double digit, it should be triple digit growth. But the bloody safe harbours and bloody YouTube are stopping the record industry from achieving its potential. And then it went on for several paragraphs in that vein. Hey, well done, America, with your growing record industry, as you say.
Let's wait and see how far Japan drags it down this year.
When we get to the global figures. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
The House of Lords has called for an extension of the Agent of Change principle.
A committee in the House of Lords has been looking at the licensing of gigs and music events in the UK, particularly England. This is one of these areas where it gets complicated because some of it is devolved in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. But they were partly looking at the Live Music Bill, which was actually a private member's bill pursued by Lord Tim Clement Jones a few years back, which aimed to simplify the bureaucracy around licensing small gigs, like in pubs and places like that. And their conclusion was the Live Music Bill is basically working, but there are some other reforms that they would like to take place, including the Agent of Change principle, which we have talked about before.
More than once.
Explain it in a sentence.
It puts the onus on property developers to protect their new developments from external venues, rather than building a new building and then people who move into it complaining about the venue next door and it being the venue's fault.
Yeah, so it's part of planning law.
It's quite a long sentence.
It was quite a long sentence. A bit of planning law that basically says that when developers take a building next to an existing venue, so the venue's already in business, and they take over a building next door and they turn it into luxury apartments, and then people move in because they think it'll be all cool to live next to a little music venue, and then they realise that music venues can be quite noisy, and they complain to the local council, and then the venue then is then forced into putting soundproofing that it can't afford through local licensing laws. And they're basically saying, as you say, that the developer needs to take responsibility for ensuring that the new residents won't be negatively infected by the existing noise. Actually, the UK government has already said that they want to put some Agent of Change style guidelines into whatever their planning book thing is. But the House of Lords are basically saying this is a great principle and we should be pushing it much more into planning law.
And finally, big news. Big news. Bob Dylan picked up his Nobel Prize.
So this was your second favourite story of 2016 and one that turned out to be true.
It is true, yeah.
That Bob Dylan really did win the Nobel Prize for Literature, whereas Ed Sheeran's face was not slashed by Princess Beatrice, as you might remember, if you're a regular listener to the podcast.
Don't remind me.
But so Bob Dylan famously made the old Nobel Prize givers go through some hoops, I think, in order to give him his prize. But he was in Stockholm for some gigs.
Yeah, he...
With a week to go.
With a week to go, he hadn't contacted them to say, oh, yeah, I'll have that prize now, thanks. And one of the, I think it was the General Secretary of the Swedish Academy, which organises the Nobel Prize in Literature, which is what Bob Dylan won, published a blog post saying he's not been in touch about that, even though he is playing two shows in Stockholm next weekend. And then
the next day, almost
the next day, he rang up and went, "Oh, yeah, I love that, but
no journalists.
It will just be me on my own and whoever from the committee."
One news agency had a picture of him in a hooded top.
Yes, of his back
going into
Could
the building.
Really, have been anyone.
But we should stress, although he has picked up the prize, the award, we're talking about the certificate and the medal.
Yes,
not the cash.
No, because obviously he didn't turn up to the ceremony in December. And in order to get the prize money, which is 8 million Swedish krona, it's about $900,000, you have to give a lecture.
And normally winners give the lecture around about that ceremony in December.
Yeah,
in
but
the
Bob
run-up.
Couldn't be bothered going to Sweden. He sent Patti Smith instead and the US ambassador to Sweden. But they thought, well, he's got these shows in Stockholm coming up, maybe he'll do it. Then they even said, oh, he could present his lecture as a concert. So basically he didn't even have to do anything.
But all he had to do was relabel one of his concerts.
He didn't even do that. And now apparently he's got till the beginning of June to give this lecture. And now they reckon he's going to tape a lecture or video a lecture and send that in, and they'll show that somewhere and then he'll get his money.
Did he still do his radio show, Bob Dylan?
I don't know.
He could just make one edition of that, his lecture, and then be done with it and get his 900 grand or whatever it is.
I suspect that it will never happen.
You won't.
I mean, as much as, you know, people said, oh, we think, you know, he's gonna tape it and send it in. He's not going to tape it and send it. It's already been, what is it? It's been months already. He's had plenty of time to think of something. He could have done it already. He's not done it. I don't think it'll happen.
But we'll regroup in June and find out, I guess.
I'm looking forward to it. It's in my diary, the date I'm looking forward to most in 2017.
For more on all of these stories, what should people do?
Oh, I think they should go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast and find the show notes for this show, where they'll find links to all those stories. Lastly, on this week's CMU podcast, it's YouTube. The oft-talked-about YouTube. And Google. As a wider thing.
And Alphabet Inc., if you want to work your way all the way up the hierarchy.
You could work your way all the way up the hierarchy. You certainly could. And maybe we will. Well, let's start with the thing that's going on with the YouTube at the moment. It's a bit of a hoo-ha. Lots of big advertisers are pulling their adverts off it.
So this has been a running story for a while now. Started over here in the UK and Europe and then sort of passed over to the US. So a number of big ad agencies and big brands have said, we're not going to advertise with YouTube. Actually, in most cases, they're saying all Google products other than Google search.
Yes.
They're still going to pump loads of money in Google's direction to get priority in the search engine. But
you don't want to shoot yourself completely in the foot.
When it comes to things like YouTube, they are saying we're putting all ad spend on hold. And the reason for that is that we know that on YouTube there is some content that a lot of people would find offensive. So some of it is just a very extreme political views. Some of it is sort of hate speech or, you know, supporting terrorism. And because the YouTube system automatically sort of pumps advertising out around content, so if a content owner puts some content into the YouTube system and says, yeah, monetize my content, then the YouTube system just automatically pulls in little banners and pre-rolls. And so what has been happening is that some big brands have started to see their ads appearing within the video or alongside this offensive extremist content. And actually, that's been happening for a long time. But yeah. The Times did a sort of investigative journalism piece on it earlier this year. And in the wake of that, lots of ad agencies and brands are now saying, whoa, yes, this actually is a bigger problem than we thought. So we're going to stop putting advertising into YouTube until Google sort this out and guarantee to us that our ads will never appear by any offensive content. So that's a running story. Google are trying to play down the problem.
This week, Google's chief business officer, Philip Schindler, said to Recode this week that he admitted that it's always been a small problem. But then he said that there are very, very small numbers of ads running against videos that aren't, and I quote, brand safe.
Brand safe is the word. So, trying to say, well, this only happens a handful of times. Although if you're the brand who's getting their ads next to some horrible piece of hate speech, it only really has to happen once, and that's a problem. So behind the scenes, Google are trying to schmooze the ad industry, and they're trying to put sort of protections in place on the platform to either stop advertising appearing next to this content or indeed just taking some of this content down. It has a bit of a music spin this week because Vevo, which obviously is the music video platform best known for all the YouTube channels that it manages on behalf of record labels, Sony, Universal, and a bunch of indies, Vevo's sales boss saw an opportunity here. So they posted a blog onto their website basically saying, well, if you advertise with us, Vevo, we control the advertising on the Vevo channels. So come and advertise with us rather than Google, I mean, they then share some of the money with Google, obviously, but come and advertise with us because we can guarantee that you will only appear on Vevo channels. And I mean, the worst that can be is a Drake video. So come and give your ad money to us and you can then have your presence on YouTube. You can reach the kids, but we will make sure your content only appears on official music industry content. And that would be lovely, wouldn't it?
And he was talking, he had some stats, he was talking it up, saying that, you know, Vevo makes up less than 0.5% of all videos on YouTube, but has 43% of YouTube's monthly audience watching Vevo content. So, you know, it's not like you're going to miss out.
And what that means is, as a brand, you can get your content onto YouTube without getting on the, what was it, brand safe? Was that the word he was using?
Brand safe.
So you can have your content brand safe. Because at the end of the day, while you're trying to make a stand against Google and forcing them to be more responsible with the content on there, you want your content on YouTube because it's the coolest of all the brands. And why wouldn't you want your brand on the cool platform? And how do we know that YouTube is the coolest of all the brands?
We know that because a report has been published this week showing that teenagers think YouTube is the very coolest brand of all.
So who commissioned this research that concluded that Google's YouTube is the coolest of all the brands?
Google.
Google.
Yeah.
So an entirely unbiased report. There was it YouGov actually did the counting?
Yeah.
So that's where the credibility may or may not be coming from. So yeah, Google have done a bit of research on which brands are, well, both awareness and coolness.
Yes.
So they support to a load of young Americans. These are Americans.
13 to 17-year-olds.
Teenagers in America. And they said to those Americans, which brands are you aware of? And of those brands, which ones are cool?
Yeah, they published a report called It's Lit, A Guide to What Teens Think Is Cool, which presumably they didn't consult any teenagers on that title. But the top three are YouTube, number one, Netflix, number two, and Google, and number three.
Yeah, so Google put all their different brands separately into this survey.
Yes.
We don't know how was this that Google went to these teenagers with a list of brands and said which of these are cool, or did they go to the teenagers cold and say, tell us some brands you know? The fact that they listed all the Google brands separately,
yeah,
but then with other companies, they just have the top-level brand, suggests to me that there was perhaps a little bit of persuasion on the part of the researchers.
Also, Chrome came in at number 10.
I don't know, perhaps Chrome is a lot bigger and cooler in the US than it is over here.
I mean, I don't speak to a lot of US teenagers, granted, so I don't know. But Chrome being number 10...
In the coolest. I mean, it's a this good browser.
The Chrome, right, fine, yeah. The report says, finding information quickly is important to busy Generation Z. They think that Chrome is cool because it's fast, reliable and easy to use. Now, those are three adjectives you could use when talking about Chrome.
But that doesn't make it cool.
That doesn't make it cool.
So YouTube is top.
Yep.
Google itself, which most people, I suppose, would probably think meant the search engine,
yep,
or maybe Google Mail, came number three. Chrome was number 10. I suppose Android is the other big...
Yeah,
Google
that came
brand
in there. That's all about the middling.
Middling.
Yeah. It was above not cool, but it was moving in that direction.
So Netflix was the highest ranking non-Google owned brand.
Yeah.
Well, none of those are really music, unless we're saying YouTube is music.
Not a lot of music brands in there.
Not a lot of music brands in there. What was the highest ranking music brand for cool?
Spotify.
Oh, Spotify.
Still not in the top 10, though.
Wow. So no Universal Music, no Sony Music, no Warner Music.
No Deezer.
No Deezer. No Tidal.
No Tidal.
No Tidal
don't
in there.
Think. I mean, it's hard, the way it's displayed, it's quite hard to pick out
an exact list. There might be a load in the middle.
I didn't really have missed things, but Spotify was definitely in there. Lower down, you've got Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Coca-Cola, Disney, all less cool than the Chrome browser.
And interestingly,
I thought kids loved Snapchat, but apparently not.
Not as much
because
as Chrome.
You can't use Snapchat in the Chrome browser. That's probably why.
That's probably why they're down on Snapchat. And of course, the other brand, which is a youth brand, big in the US, Vice was surprisingly low down.
Second least cool.
And
only beaten by the Wall Street Journal for being not cool.
So slightly cooler than the Wall Street Journal, but a lot less cool than Chrome.
Anything else.
So I don't know if Google have any reason to try and push Vice down. They possibly do, except that Vice has a big YouTube channel, doesn't it?
So, it's got several big YouTube channels.
So I'm not quite sure whether or not that is an accurate representation of the teens' opinion of Vice.
Would you like to hear a quote from a teenager?
Yeah, a quote from a teenager sounds good.
Because they had one.
An American teenager.
This is the sort of thing an American teenager will tell you. Google is really cool because it is an innovator, a trendsetter. Google is not only a powerful search engine, but great at everything it does, from email to documents. Google products are easy to use and work well. As a company, Google also stands for education and creativity, shown by the science fairs and doodles contests they host. Just the normal sort of thing that a teenager might say.
Yeah, take note, Vice. Those are the things that interest the average American teenager, and that's what you should be doing. Although music brands, unless we're claiming YouTube and Apple, things like that as music brands, which you almost could. But although music brands didn't appear very highly in this survey, when they started asking these teenagers about celebrities and who were the cool people, then music did do better.
The cool brands list, they asked over 1,000 teenagers that. They did a smaller survey with about 400 teenagers where they just asked them about the cool things, and some of them liked music. About 13% of girls thought that music was the coolest thing. That sounds bad, but it was second place. Boys like music less. About 6% said that music was the coolest. Joint seventh. Other came considerably higher than music.
Putting it behind miscellaneous. Yeah. Although in that survey, other has an advantage in that it's covering an awful lot of things.
Yeah.
Aggregated together. So didn't do so well in a list of brands. Did all right, although not particularly impressive, percentage stats in sort of the coolest thing, pastime, hobby, stuff that interests you. But then the people list.
Yeah, when you're asking about celebrities, they like music does better or musicians do better. So in the top five coolest celebrities, you had Ariana Grande, you had Selena Gomez, and you had Chance the Rapper.
So I suppose that proves that point that a lot of people sort of in the artist and management community say, which is that the music industry is ultimately lots of artist businesses.
Yeah.
The artists are the brands in music. Forget the label brands, the service brands. It's all about the artists.
They also put together a list of what artists, teenagers collectively, would put on their teenager playlist.
Okay, so this was where, they kept honing down the survey. So now they're specifically asking about what music these teenagers, did they just ask the 6% who said they liked music?
I don't know.
Or did they ask all the 94% who don't really like music?
That would explain
the list.
Just bear in mind that this is a list compiled by the sort of teenager who would give the quote I read out previously. They would like 21 Pilots, Drake, The Beatles, Panic at the Disco, Fall Out Boy, Beyonce and Coldplay on their playlist.
It's interesting.
That's music that teenagers like. They like Ariana Grande, Selena Gomez and Chance the Rapper as people. They would not like to have them in a playlist that they're going to listen to.
No, they like their Instagram accounts, but they don't want to listen to their music. When it comes to it's the Beatles, that's the music they want to listen to.
And Coldplay. Even the report itself. The end it says Coldplay, and then in brackets it says, yeah, we know. Report on teenagers being cool that then disses the teenagers for what they like.
But YouTube overall is the coolest of the cool, even if it has all of that terrible extremist content that's turning the advertisers off, and even if the RIAA think that it is preventing the record industry from getting the kind of double-digit, triple-digit growth that it should be getting. So YouTube is evil, but cool. Which sort of thing?
Well, yeah.
Because evil is cool, isn't it? In the movies, the bad people, they're sort of often the
cool
people.
You want to play the bad guy.
Yeah. Mm. So that's a nice little logical conclusion there.
So, to this edition. Something to be learned.
Of the CMU podcast. Hey, I've just got a low battery message on my phone, so we're going to have to wrap this podcast up. Otherwise, I won't be able to read your excellent notes.
Well, we've finished anyway, so
good.
You don't need to read them. I'll just wrap it up. You can subscribe to this podcast if you don't already. I mean, why are you not? But, you know, maybe this is the first time you've listened to it, in which case I will let your error pass on this occasion, although I'm surprised you didn't subscribe halfway through or even in the first 5 minutes.
You can
some gold chat in today's intro.
You can also sign up via all of the possible platforms via which you could get a podcast, although we are not on YouTube.
No, we're not.
It's the one platform we shun given the lack of video in this. Some podcasts actually sort of have slideshows, don't they? So it sort of moves on as the conversation moves on.
Oh, see. God, it sounds tedious, doesn't it? They say YouTube's cool. Boring.
Well, and we're not on there, so how could it be cool?
Exactly.
I think we've completely pulled apart that last bit of research. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted your outro.
Yeah, just subscribe to the podcast. If you've got an iPhone, it's got a podcast app in it. Maybe you're not using it. It's just a waste. Use it.
What if they don't have an iPhone?
Get one.
Even though it's not in the cool list, get an iPhone. Stop using Chrome and Android.
Apple may not have been the coolest. It was higher than Android. there was more awareness of Apple than there was of Google. Some teenagers looked a researcher in the eye and said, Google, never heard of it.
Given the Beatles was in their playlist, that it's Apple Core that they know. That would make sense.
Well, maybe the stats are doubled up and teenagers haven't really heard of either of those brands. Who knows? Anyway, we've gone back into a discussion.
We just closed off.
This is bad audio now. I'm now embarrassed to say that this podcast was presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook.
Do the outro of the outro.
And Matt Peaty produced
it. Well, as a producer, it was his job to keep us in line, really.
He should have stopped us. Yeah. And he didn't. This is all a disaster. For more on CMU, don't go to our website. Don't ever listen to this podcast again. It's just...
Tell you what.
So unprofessional. Oh, look what you've done now.
Let's not bother doing an outro, and we'll do it next week and people can put it back in themselves.
Oh, right, that bit, yeah.
Okay.
We'll do the outro next week.
Yeah, we promise.
We'll do it better. All right, do subscribe. Come back next week. We'll be better next week.
We promise to do the outro properly
next
week.
I'm so sorry.
And you can replicate it back.
Bye.
Jingle.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Oh, something pinged.
Yeah.